of Youngbak Kim from University of Toronto, talking, lightning review on quantum tunneling.
Okay. So my mission today is to give you some background for quantum spinlicate. A lot of these things will be discussed in the conference next week. So here is the outline of the talk today. So I like to define what the quantum spinlicate really is, how we think about this, and overview of experiment, then overview of some basic theories. Then using these theories, we like to interpret some of the experiment, if it's possible. So that's basically the outline. Okay, so we heard a lot about the classical limit of this frustrated magnet. So the first thing I'd like to emphasize is that what do you mean by quantum spinlicate is not this classical spinlicate, or sometimes we call cooperative paramagnet. So in this case, we are dealing with a large number of equally unhappy classically degenerate ground state. And this is typical the behavior of, say, inverse susceptibility as a function of temperature. And we understand that there's a big region in big window of temperature where basically magnetic ordering is suppressed and susceptibility still follows the Curie bias behavior. And so this behavior occurs because of the presence of highly degenerate classical ground state manifold, and this is what we call classical spinlicate, and this is not what I would call quantum spinlicate. And we also know that this is different from boring incoherent high temperature paramagnet, where basically spins don't talk to each other, each spin is doing its own thing, and there is no coherent motion of the spin excitations. So this is definitely not a quantum spinlicate. So, but we have a very good example of quantum spinlicate in one dimension. That's basically spin half Heisenberg model in 1D. So we know that the ground state is spinlicate. We know the exact solution of this thing. And we also have an experimental system where the excitation spectrum is actually measured. So the point is that this is a quantum paramagnet, and there's no translation symmetry breaking. And the coherent excitations of such a system is the spin half carrying spin on. And ideally, perhaps the best way to see this excitation is the neutron scattering, because neutron scattering measures the spin one excitation, as you know. And in this system, there is no magnetic order, so there is no magnons or anything like this. So the only excitation I have is a spin half carrying spin on. So one way to make a spin on excitation is to excite spin on anti spin on pair excitation. And in this case, typically what happens is that if you look at, say, the intensity of neutron scattering structure factor in omega cube plane, and you will discover that only above some threshold energy, you start to see the continuum of spin-on, anti-spin-on pair excitation. And in fact, this threshold energy at different momentum is basically determined by some kind of convolution of spin-on spectrum and anti-spin-on spectrum. So there's a formal way of computing this threshold energy by looking at the at different, you know, the spin-on dispersion at different momentum. So, for example, this kind of spin-on anti-spin-on continuum were actually observed in a one-dimensional Heisenberg model, and that was the confirmation of the 1D, the presence of quantum spin liquid in one dimension. So the question is, can we do this kind of thing, or can this kind of grounds exist in higher dimension? So in higher dimension, we are talking about quantum paramagnet where there is no magnetic order. So typically there are two different situations. So for example, you could break a translational symmetry, and then the resulting ground state may be a valence bond solid. Here I'm representing a singlet bond between two sites, so made out of two spins like this. And if they arrange in a periodic fashion like this by breaking a translational symmetry, that state we call a valence bond solid. And in fact, in the conference next week, several people will be talking about different kinds of valence bond solid. For example, this material is some kind of dimerized valence bond solid state on a deformed Gaugamel lattice. And there will be talks about Schestri standard lattice like that. So, but this is not the topic of today. And what we are really interested in at this hour, in this hour, is the spin liquid, where we don't have any broken transition symmetry. So in this case, the elementary excitations of such a system is this charging neutral spin half excitations. You may or may not have a spin gap, because this spin on this the neutral spin half excitation may or may not have a gap, excitation gap. So the mental picture of the spin liquid phase is often described by this this picture, originally proposed by Phil Anderson. So you think about this valence bond between different sites. Then imagine that I'm thinking about the valence bond covering of a given lattice like that. But then you can think about the different kinds of valence bond covering. Now, if you do the superposition of various different kinds of valence bond configuration, you immediately realize that such a superposition will lead to a translationally invariant liquid kind of ground state. Because for each valence bond solid configuration, you're breaking some kind of translational symmetry. But if you superpose them, basically, then there is no breaking of the translational symmetry. So this is one way to think about a spin liquid state. So according to this picture, you can think about two kinds of spin liquid state in terms of valence bond. Say, so imagine that your valence bond, or singlet, mainly resides between, say, nearest neighbor site, or it has a finite length scale. Then you can imagine that the spin-spin correlation function in such a system will decay exponentially with some length scale xi. And this length scale xi basically reflects the fundamental length scale of your valence bond element. But on the other hand, you can also imagine that you have a valence bond between two different spins, but that may be arbitrarily far away. Now imagine that if I think about a valence bond covering of the lattice with an arbitrary distance between two spins, then you immediately realize that in this problem, there is no fundamental length scale. There's no length scale in this problem. So naturally, the spin-spin correlation function will decay algebraically. So you can think about two kinds of situations like this. And typically, if you have such a situation, typically you have a finite spin-on gap. In this case, quite often your spin-ons don't have an excitation gap. And this, when your spin liquid displays behavior like this, sometimes such a state is called a critical spin liquid, mainly because the spin-spin correlation function decays algebraically. So there are various spin half candidate material for spin liquid known to today. So one of the most famous materials is organic materials. So these are the you make a dimers of this organic molecule. Then each unit acts like a effective spin half degree of freedom. Then those dimers are arranged in such a way that you make a triangular lattice. So you can think about such a system as a model for the material for a triangular lattice Hubbard model. And so this is one possible candidate for a spin liquid ground state. And there are now several other candidate materials for Gaugomel lattice. For example, this Hubbard-Smith site is supposed to represent the most ideal Gaugomel lattice structure. And these two other materials may give you a slightly deformed version of the Gaugomel lattice. Then now there's also a three-dimensional version of this. So this is what people call hyper-Gaugomel lattice. So one way to think about this lattice is as follows. So if you start from a particle lattice like this, then there are four sides in each tetrahedron. And imagine that only three of the four sides is magnetic, the other side is non-magnetic. Then the remaining magnetic lattice, if you connect all the sides, you discover that that basically becomes a corner-sharing triangle. And so you can think of this as a three-dimensional version of the two-dimensional Gaugomel lattice. So such a material exists here. Here, what is magnetic is iridium. And in fact, in all of these materials, it was shown that down to the very low temperature, basically there is no magnetic ordering. So this is the typical behavior observed in these materials. Say if you measure the inverse susceptibility as a function of temperature, again, you don't see any signature of clear magnetic ordering. And quite often, you get a constant susceptibility. And heat capacity decays as a power law as you decrease temperature. So, but remember that these are actually all charging insulators. So the fact that you have a constant susceptibility and power law heat capacity, it means that there are low energy excitation that carry entropy, because you can see it in the heat capacity, and they actually also carry spin quantum number because it shows up in the susceptibility. So the natural conclusion from this data may be that there are a lot of low energy excitation. These are charge neutral because there's a charge gap, but they may actually carry a spin quantum number, and they obviously carry entropy. So one possible candidate ground state for such a behavior is a basic spin liquid with a gapless spin-on excitation, because spin-on is charge neutral that carries both spin quantum number and entropy. So that's basically the motivation behind to think about such a data set as an evidence for the presence of quantum spin liquid state in these materials. So again, I'm just showing you the susceptibility data for this different material. This is the deformed Gaugomel lattice bulbocyte. This is Herbert-Smith site. This is for the organic material, and this is for the three-dimensional hypergaugomel lattice. And notice that they all sort of show constant susceptibility or significant low energy spin excitations. And heat capacity seems to be all going to zero as a power law. And these two data set is actually well obtained for the powder sample, but in the conference next week, there will be a report from Genji Hiroi's group about a single crystal data. So basically you will see a slightly different data set. And also Young Lee will talk about his new thermodynamic and neutron scattering data on single crystal samples of Herbert-Smith site. So, okay. So I told you about this material, but as a theorist, we think about those systems into two different categories. In fact, it turns out that these two materials are very, very good insulator. But these two classes of materials are actually very close to metal insulator transition. And that has some important implication to the theory. The reason is as follows. But before I do that, this is the evidence that these two materials are very close to metal insulator transition. So for example, when you apply a pressure, you can make this insulator to be a metallic state or even superconductor in this organic material. For sodium idate, notice that by applying a 7 gigapascal, you can change the resistivity by 3 orders of magnitude. So these materials are really very close to metal insulator transition. So the point is as follows. So imagine that I'm talking about some kind of Hubbard model. And we understand that if I go to a large U limit, namely the big charge gap limit, then the effective spin model is an Heisenberg model. Basically, you have a nearest neighbor exchange coupling like this. But now, if I decrease my charge gap further and further, and I'm approaching metal insulator transition point, then since my charge gap is decreasing, I can excite more and more virtual charge excitation. And when I have more and more virtual charge excitation, I can easily generate the longer and longer range exchange interactions. So you can imagine that by going into going very close to metal insulator transition, I end up with a spin model where I basically have exchange coupling between two spins that are very, very far away. So in this sense, by generating this longer range exchange coupling, your effective spin model will be highly frustrating. So what that means is that near a metal insulator transition, you typically have a quite frustrating spin interactions. And so hope is that this will help us to find the quantum spin liquid state. So that's basically the general idea. So for example, let's take this organic material. Both of them are sitting on a triangular lattice. And we know that in the large U limit, the model is the Heisenberg model. And we know that the ground state is 120 degree order antiferromagnet. But even if this is the case, the claim is that if you're very close to a metal insulator transition boundary, then the spin model you have to think about is not a nearest neighbor Heisenberg model. It's actually a highly frustrated spin model. And because of that, you can stabilize the spin liquid state. So this one idea. In fact, for hypergaugomel lattice, it turns out that even the large U limit, the spin model is highly frustrated. So we believe that perhaps including a metal insulator transition boundary, you may have a much larger window of a spin liquid insulator. So if you have such a situation, and in particular, if the transition between metal and spin liquid is a continuous transition. Then the natural theoretical conclusion from such a consideration is that perhaps the spin-on excitation will inherit the Fermi surface of electron. If that's the case, then the spin-on excitations in these phases can actually form a Fermi surface, and that Fermi surface is a remnant of electron Fermi surface in the metallic state. And perhaps that's the reason why you can see, for example, linearly vanishing heat capacity in experiments of these two systems. So this one theoretical idea that you may want to remember. And very recently, there have been claims to there have been various claims about discovering spin liquid phases in this kind of material. This is the barium, copper, antimony, oxygen 9. So originally it was thought that the structure of this material is a AB stacking of the triangular lattice. And after some data analysis, they showed that heat capacity may be going to zero linearly and susceptibility may be constant. So this is like what you see in an organic material or the hypergalgamon lattice. But there are, and various people will talk about this material in the conference. But very recently, there have been very, very careful study on this material. And it appears that the structure of this material may not be just simple AB stacking of the triangular lattice. But nonetheless, there are interesting spin orbital entanglement going on in this material. The ground state may still remain disordered. So Nakajuji will talk about this material. So I just want to advertise this. This is already mentioned in the previous talk. There's also a spin one version of this system. And again, it shows the classic behavior of constant susceptibility and linearly vanishing heat capacity. So the question is whether the ground state of this system can be also a quantum spin liquid state or not. And Balikas will talk about this on Tuesday. Okay. So now let's go to the theory, because in order to I gave you all sorts of pictures and all that, but theories cannot live their life just drawing cartoons, right? So I have to do a little bit more serious business. So I'd like to give you some Mickey Mouse version of the theory. Unfortunately, I don't think that I have enough time to tell you the full-fledged theory. So what I'm going to do is something like this. So hopefully, at least I can achieve that much, right? Okay. So important questions to ask here is like, what's the ground state wave function for spin liquid? That's one important question. All the important discovery in condensed matter, I mean theoretical discovery, was done by writing down the ground state wave function. Yeah, so BCS wave function, Loplin wave function for quantum Hall state. So why don't you think about writing down a wave function for spin liquid? So this is a very natural question. So here is one way to think about the variational wave function for a spin liquid state. So we often use what people call slip particle approach. So here is my localized spin. Then I like to represent it in terms of some kind of fermionic apparatus using usual Pauli matrix. So in order to do that, I have to impose the constraint. The number of particles per site is actually exactly one. So this constraint is very important to make sure that your representation of spin like this basically satisfy proper spin commutation relation. Then quite often we have to solve this Heisenberg model like this. Then once you write down such a model in terms of the fermionic degree of freedom, you immediately encounter something like four fermion interaction. So at this stage, you didn't make any progress. Basically, you transform one difficult problem to even more difficult problem. So basically, it's a transformation between two equally difficult problems. So the way to make a progress is to make some kind of mean field ansatz. So notice that this four fermion interaction may give you two different kinds of correlation between particle, this fermionic particle. You may have a particle Hall-like correlation. You may also have like a particle-particle-like correlation. So this is like generating a kinetic energy. This actually has to be J index. So this, you may generate a kinetic energy of those fermions. You may also generate a pairing between those fermions. So there are two kinds of fundamental correlation between fermions. So once you propose that, say, something some some correlation likes can be established, then you can write down a mean field wave function, so mean field Hamiltonian. So basically, you decouple your Fermi interaction in two different channels. So this is particle Hall like, this is particle particle like. You immediately notice that the mean field Hamiltonian looks exactly like a BCS Hamiltonian. And this is like a kinetic energy of the fermion. It's like a pairing of fermions. And but if you do the mean field theory, on the other hand, this constraint, the number of particles per site is, has to be exactly one, just becomes mean field version of the constraint, namely that the average number of particles per site becomes one. So there is a trade-off you have to make in this kind of mean field theory. So one thing I like to emphasize is that once you generate a correlation like this, notice that, for example, this chi is something like a kinetic energy of those fermions, and this will give you some kind of band structure for the this fermionic particle. Notice that in the original problem, basically, there is no kinetic energy. This is the ultimate strong interaction problem. I only have interaction, there is no kinetic energy, remember? So if I generate a kinetic energy like this, it has nothing to do with the kinetic energy scale in my original problem, because I only had an interaction energy scale, J. What that means is that my kinetic energy of those particles is an interaction effect. It's not a non-interacting band structure. That's very, very important. Okay, so now you have a mean field theory in terms of those mean field parameters. It can be shown that not every choice of chi and delta is independent, and that's because of some symmetry, especially there's some kind of Gaussian Lattice symmetry transformation, and that basically connects different answers for chi and delta. And the full classification requires what people call projective symmetric group analysis. This is proposed by Xiaogang Wen, and he can give you a lecture about this for 5 hours. That's probably not enough. But I'm not going to talk about this today. So there are, you know, you have to be very careful when you make a mean field answer. So that's basically one thing you want to remember. So when you end up with gap spin liquid, and such a symmetry classification scheme basically give you some characteristic of those spin liquid phases. And when the spin liquid is gap, this is called topological order. When your spin liquid is gapless, then sometimes it's called quantum order. So these are the terminology you may encounter in various literatures. Okay, but remember that when I do the mean field theory, then the important constraint, namely the fermion number per site has to be exactly one, is violated. You can only satisfy that on average. So that's obviously I'm violating fundamental principle here in some sense, because in order to satisfy that commutation relation, I really have to impose this constraint exactly. So there's a way to do so. So this is what we call projection. So basically, you project out all the double occupancy. So remember that original constraint is like I have exactly one particle per site, but when I think about a mean field state where only the average number of particles is exactly one, you know, there are some empty sites, there are some doubly occupied sites in my mean field state. So I like to remove all these unphysical states. So that's called projection. So I start from a mean field answer, then I do the projection. Then chi and delta in such a wave function can be regarded as a variational parameter. So what you do is you propose this as a variational wave function. You compute the expectation value of Hamiltonian, gives you energy. You minimize your energy. Then you find the configuration of chi and delta that gives the minimum energy. That's your ground state. So the usual variational procedure. Yeah? So if you do that, then one thing that comes out of this study is that when you compute energies of the mean field state, various mean field state, that you want to find the lowest energy ground state, and you do the projection, then you ranking the state, quite often ranking of the ground state energy changes. So what that means is that this projection is extremely important, extremely important. So this is for the theory students. Okay, so quite often you also encounter literature talking about gauge theory. So why we have to worry about the gauge theory here? So the reason is as follows. So imagine that, you know, I start with the mean field Hamiltonian. So I told you that this is the mean field Hamiltonian, it's the BCS form. Then imagine that I only have a chi, not delta. So I don't have a pairing correlation. I only have an emergent kinetic energy. And in this case, notice that chi is in general a complex number. So I can write it as a magnitude and phase. And once you write down a Hamiltonian like that, you immediately realize that this Hamiltonian has a U1 gauge symmetry, in the sense that if you do the gauge transformation for your fermion operator or the wave function, then you have to do the corresponding transformation for the gauge field, Aij, or the phase of the chi. So that Hamiltonian is invariant under U1 gauge transformation. And because of this, your fermion, your fermionic spinon, are interacting with the U1 gauge field. Here, Aij acts like a magnetic vector potential. On the other hand, if you have a pairing as well as kinetic energy, then this really corresponds to the BCS state of the spinon. And if you have this pairing correlation, then you discover that you don't have a U1 gauge invariance. You only have an invariant on the sine transformation, or the Ising transformation. Sometimes it's called G2 transformation. So the link field, Aij, can only have a plus minus 1. And only then your Hamiltonian is invariant. So your symmetry is broken down to G2 or Ising symmetry from U1 symmetry. So that's why this kind of spin liquid is called U1 spin liquid. And this kind of spin liquid is called G2 spin liquid. Okay? So if you don't want to remember this, it looks very complicated. But actually quite simple. If you only have a kinetic energy, no pairing, then that's a U1 spin liquid. If you have a pairing between spinon, then you have a G2 spin liquid. So that is as simple as that. Okay. So again, if I think about the variation wave function, then for the U1 spin liquid, basically you have some kind of band structure of the fermion. Then you want to do the projection. You want to take out all the unphysical doubly occupied site. For the G2 spin liquid, you start from a BCS state of those fermions. Then you project out the doubly occupied site. Then that's basically your variation wave function. So at this stage, you may say, OK, what kind of intuition I can get out of this wave function? So it turns out that it's very easy to build an intuition, especially for the G2 spin liquid. The argument is as follows. So imagine that I'm starting with a BCS superconductor. But imagine that I have a situation where average number of electron per site is 1. Yeah? It's a superconductor, so there are lots of charge fluctuations. Yeah? So average number of particle per site is 1. But you know, in principle, you can have 2 fermions at a site, right? Because you allow charge fluctuation. So I have a BCS wave function for this state. Now imagine that I'm increasing my interaction between electrons. So I'm increasing my Hubbard U. I'm increasing, increasing, increasing. And when U becomes infinity, you know that you cannot occupy the same site by 2 fermions, right? At the end of the day, I should have a situation where I have exactly 1 particle per site in the larger limit, in the limit that U goes infinity. Okay? So there, because of this projection, or the large U or repulsion between fermions, I have exactly 1 particle per site. Yeah? So this spin liquid wave function that we talked about, you can think of that as a large U limit of the BCS wave function. So it's very simple. Yeah? So that's the way that you can impose this constraint of exactly 1 particle per site. So in this sense, your valence bond, singlet, is like incoherent Cooper pair. There's no charge coherence between Cooper pairs, but they are just fluctuating around. So that's basically your RBB spin liquid. Okay, so then what are the spinons? So remember that in superconductors, elementary excitations are Vogel-Volkoji particles. So for Vogel-Volkoji particle, you know, it's a superposition of particle state and Hall state. If you have a particle symmetry, particle Hall symmetry, like you know, average number of particles per site is 1, then the average charge of the Kozy particle is 0. But it carries spin half quantum number. Now again, if I increase how about U in such a way that I freeze out charge fluctuation, then notice that projection of Vogel-Volkoji particle will have exactly 0 charge. Exactly 0 charge. There's no charge fluctuations anymore. The point is, in superconductor, actually charge is not a good quantum, charge of the quasi particle is not a good quantum number, remember? Because charge is not conserved in superconductor. But you can still talk about average charge. But when you freeze out all the charge fluctuations so that it becomes an insulator in the larger limit, then I can talk about the charge quantum number. In this case, in this sense, the spinons is a descendant of Bolzano quasi particle, and you basically end up with exactly zero charge, but it carries spin half quantum number. So in that sense, this represents the fractionalization of electrons. So this is one way to think about spinon excitations in quantum supermarket. Does it make sense? Okay. And now imagine that I take a short coherence length slur, so then my Cooper pair size is very, very small. There's one lattice spacing. Yeah. So then the corresponding valence bond sort of configuration looks like this. So this represents incoherent Cooper pair, if you like. Then you can show that there are two kinds of configuration if you put the system on a cylinder. So for example, in this case, if you fix a cut, then you will be intersecting even number of valence bond. In this case, you'll be intersecting odd number of valence bond. The point is that if you start from such a configuration, by making a local movement, you can never go to the other state. So these two states are topologically distinct. Okay? And therefore, people say there's a non-trivial ground state degeneracy. For example, if you put G2 spin liquid, for example, on a cylinder, then you see, say, two ground states, two different ground states. They are orthogonal to each other. So this is what people call ground state degeneracy, non-trivial ground state degeneracy. Okay, so now we have these situations like I can have a U1 spin liquid or a G2 spin liquid. Now it turns out the U1 spin liquid in two dimensions, if your spinons are gapped out, then such a state is not stable. Okay? In three dimensions, you can show that such a state can be stable. And depending on, but if you have a gapless situation, if your fermionic spinon is gapless, then depending on the spectrum of your spinon excitation, you can have a different kinds of behavior for heat capacity. For example, if your spinons have Fermi surface, then your heat capacity may be proportional to temperature, just like a metallic system. But if you have a Dirac point, then obviously you will get T square behavior. But in three dimension, again, if you have a Fermi surface, heat capacity will be linear in temperature. If you have a line node, then you will get a T square behavior like that. So it really depends on the fermionic spectrum. What is not discussed here is the effect of this gauge field fluctuation that I talked about. It's the fluctuation above the ground state. So it turns out that if you include those effects, the fluctuation beyond the mean field theory, then if you have a 2D Fermi surface, the capacity actually becomes more singular, like a T^2/3. Okay? For three-dimensional case, you acquire a logarithmic correction. And if you have a totally gapped case, then you still have an emergent photon, the gauge field contribution. And remember that those gauge field has a linear dispersion, just like a usual electrodynamics. So here, the capacity has to be, say, proportional to TQ, just like a phonons spin waves in three dimensions. So for example, the reason why these discussions are important is because you see some temperature-dependent heat capacity, for example, and you like to see which one of these framework may actually fit into that data set. So that's why you want to know, you may want to know which behaviors to expect. Yes? Pardon? What? Yeah. So I'm saying spinons are gap. Yeah. Yeah. So the gauge field will be always gapless in the U1 spin liquid. So this contribution always exists here. But point is that, the gap case. Okay, now if you have a G2 spin liquid, remember that G2 spin liquid is like, it's like a BCS state of fermionic spinon, yeah? So this state can be stable both in 2D and 3D. It can support various kinds of structures. For example, you know, imagine that your fermionic spinon is in a D-wave BCS state. Then, for example, you can support the Dirac point, just like a D-wave superconductor. Now, in the fully gapped case, again, in that case, obviously, your heat capacity will be exponentially activated. The point is, what should be the activation gap? So this activation gap is actually the activation gap of a particle called vison. So the way to think about this is as follows. Remember that in G2 spin naked, I have an Ising variable that basically acts like a gauge field defined on the link. And say it can be plus one, minus one. So the ground state, in the ground state, this link variable is always all plus one or all minus one. But once in a while, you can have a defect. So imagine I create a defect like this, you know, at one of the link changes sign. So this kind of excitation is the low energy excitation. And the excitation gap is, in fact, quite often governed by this type of excitation. And the point is, this excitation is actually charged neutral. This also doesn't carry spin. So it only carries entropy. So important consequence will be like this. So imagine that I'm measuring a heat capacity and susceptibility. And these vison excitations don't carry any spin. So it's not going to show up in a susceptibility measurement. So you will only see a spin-on gap in the heat capacity, in the susceptibility. But in capacity, but heat capacity will see both vison gap and spin-on gap. So imagine that, you know, you measure the heat capacity of some material. You have this situation where, you know, susceptibility is enhanced, exponentially activated at some energy scale. But there's additional activation below that. So that can be interpreted as a vison gap in a G2 spin naked. And in the gapless case, you know, of course, you can have a node in your your pairing wave function. Then you can have a various temperature dependence again. Right. So in general, you know, the fact that you get some temperature, non-trivial temperature dependent heat capacity, and in fact, this is often seen in candidate spin naked material that I mentioned. It indicates that there are low energy spin carrying excitations, and perhaps these are spin-ons, and that's the motivation behind this spin naked research. Okay, so now we are armed with this Mickey Mouse version of the theory. You may not think that this is a Mickey Mouse version, but actually it is. I have to claim. So then armed with this theory, let's look at the various material and see whether I can make sense out of it. So let's start with the organic material. So again, various people looked at this problem. Basically, you know, you can think about constructing an effective Hamiltonian near the metal insulator transition. And you apply a variation wave function strategy. And people found that the ground state is exactly something like this. So you generate a kinetic energy of those fermionic spin-on. But it turns out that it doesn't generate a pairing correlation. So there is an emergent kinetic energy of spin-on, fermionic spin-on. So you get some kind of Fermi surface of the spin-on excitation. So if you have Fermi surface of spin-on, fermionic spin-on, and obviously at the mean field level, you will get linear in temperature dependence in heat capacity. Yeah? And that's sort of what is observed in experiment. So you may say, wow, OK, so now my business is finished. I explained this experiment, right? But as I emphasized, this is not a full story. The point is that if you do a naive theory, you get a linear in temperature dependence like this. If you do a slightly more sophisticated theory, basically including fluctuation effect, then you actually get a T2D two-third. Yeah? This is not what you see in the experiment. Yeah? So this is a situation where you have to scratch your head. Okay? Your more sophisticated theory doesn't really explain your data. But then, you can improve the situation by including other fluctuations near the metal insulator transition boundary. For example, when I do this kind of calculation, I didn't include, for example, charge fluctuation taken into account in my calculation. In principle, I can do that. Then you can show that this T to the two-thirds behavior may become T times log of 1 over temperature. But still, we have a logarithmic enhancement. Again, this logarithmic enhancement was never seen in the real system. So you see, this is the data. You see that in experiment, you clearly see finite gamma term. It's pretty linear. In fact, if you measure 1 over T1, 1 over T1 is also proportional to temperature, just like a metallic system. So in many ways, heat capacity, susceptibility, and 1 over T1, they all behave like I have a metal. So So for the spin degree of freedom, for all practical purposes, they behave like a metallic system. It's just that there's a charge gap. And if you calculate the Wilson ratio, then there's also order one number, just like a metal. Yeah. But again, as I said, you know, more sophisticated theory, you don't get that. You actually get a slightly different power law. So guessing how you can possibly reconcile this. And another interesting discovery was that in this kappa BEGT material, for this material, if you measure the thermal conductivity divided by temperature, and if the spin degree of freedom that actually carries entropy, that is really behaving like a metallic system, you'd expect the kappa by T should approach constant, the low temperature level. But in this material, as you can see from this plot, it turns out the kappa by T actually goes to zero as T goes to zero. And this is inconsistent with the Fermi surface proposal of spinor excitations. So even though other data may be consistent with that, but this data is not. Okay? And there's also some characteristic kink around 5 Kelvin in the heat capacity data. Professor Kanoda may talk about this next week. Okay. So because of this, there are various theoretical proposals in what may be the true ground state of this material. So one of the proposals is that at below a certain temperature, you actually form a pairing of those spinor objects. So it actually becomes gap. You know, basically, it's like a superconducting transition, if you like. But below some temperature, there's a formation of basically paired fermions, and that becomes G2 spin liquids. So there are various proposals like that. There are better organic material in some sense, especially in the point of view of thermal conductivity data. This is another organic material, the triangular lattice. This material also show linear in temperature heat capacity. But at the same time, for this material, kappa by T is actually finite. The T goes zero limit. So you may say this is a classic Fermi surface behavior, if spinons are really forming a Fermi surface. And there will be an NMR data, will be presented about this material on, I believe, on Wednesday. Okay. The Hoover-Smith site, for this material, the heat capacity, again, follows some power law behavior. Maybe susceptibility is constant. There are debates whether this is extrinsic or intrinsic. But now there's a single crystal. So I think this issue can be easily resolved. So the leading theory for spin liquid state is what people call Yuan Dirac spin liquid. So it's a Yuan spin liquid where spinons actually have a Dirac spectrum in two dimensions. Because spinons have a Dirac spectrum, the capacity goes like T square. The susceptibility has to be proportional to temperature. And again, you don't see this linear in temperature susceptibility in the experiment. So in order to explain the experimental data, they basically you have to use disorder to play, and you have to play with this impurity kind of degree of freedom to explain the experimental data. So there's no direct confirmation of this theory so far. There are other candidates for the for the ground state of the Heisenberg model on the Kagome lattice. This is called the valence bond solid state with a 36 unit cell. So this is the valence bond solid, a very complicated valence bond configuration. And if this is the true ground state, the thermal the heat capacity will be thermally activated. But this delta, the gap, spin gap, can be actually quite small. Yeah. And more recently, there's a more sophisticated numerical study. It's a density matrix normalization group study by Stephen White and David Hughes. And they found that the ground state is like a spin liquid with a finite spin gap. And they have some evidence for the G2 spin liquid. For example, they can see this topological degeneracy that I talked about for the G2 spin liquid in their numerical calculation. So the question is whether such a state can be a ground state of, say, Hoover-Smith site. It's an open question. And this numerical study will be presented on Thursday by Stephen White. OK, so as I mentioned earlier, for Hoover-Smith site, now single crystal is available. I think they really made a heroic effort to make this. So notice that this is the susceptibility, you know, actually they are plotting susceptibility times temperature. So this is the, say, the red curve is the susceptibility, say, when H is along the C axis, perpendicular to the Gagomer layer. And, sorry, parallel, to, so yeah, then H, say, in the plane. So that's the black line. And the powder data is basically, you know, some kind of average of these two directions. So there is some kind of spin on isotropy. So it's clear that the spin model for this material is not an isotropic Heisenberg model. You have some on isotropy. But nonetheless, as far as susceptibility data goes, it looks as if powder data is like some average of these two directions. And heat capacity shows, still shows some power law behavior, et cetera, et cetera. But most importantly, very recent neutron scattering on this material see some kind of two-spin-on continuum. So they see, you know, basically excitations, some kind of diffuse excitations, you know, just like what you would expect for the two-spin-on excitation. And even though there is really no magnetic ordering down to very low temperature. So I believe Young Lee will talk about this on Thursday. So it's a coming attraction. Yeah. Okay. How much time do I have? Okay. So I'll skip this. Then I'm going to talk about this quantum spin ions because this is really the new kid on the block. Okay. So this is slightly different. So this system is different from all of the systems that I talked about. So that's why I wanted to talk about this. Okay. So again, we are talking about layers paracloth. So AB site, you know, it's a paracloth lattice. So there were a lot of talks about this, so I don't have to explain this. Okay. So these 4F electrons on the A site, these are well localized. And so because of the strong spin-orbit coupling, the local J eigenstate, total angular momentum state split by crystal field. So quite often you discover that ground state is a doublet. So we have some kind of effective spin half description with the local quantization actions. That's basically usual spin ice actions, right? Usual Ising actions. Okay. So various people wrote down so effective spin Hamiltonian like this. And notice that if I don't have these two terms, it's like a usual XXG kind of model. But you allow this kind of term because you actually have a spin-orbit coupling in my system. So okay, it's okay. So the point is that if you only have this term, this is like a classical spin ice, right? Ising coupling. And this represents the quantum fluctuation because those operators don't commit with the SG operator. So it gives you quantum dynamic. Right? That's why we call it quantum spin ice. Okay? And the point is if you only have this term, and in this case, you still have SG conservation. So this Hamiltonian still conserves SG quantum number. So you can actually solve it more easily. So this represents a very simple quantum fluctuation. And back in 2004, these people showed that the ground state in this limit, when Ising coupling is much, much bigger than transverse coupling, the ground state can be a quantum spin linkage state. So this was a perturbative argument. And it's supposed to be a U1 gauge theory. And this is a perturbative calculation, but there was a non-perturbative calculation by some of us. We did a quantum Monte Carlo simulation on this. Indeed, we discovered that if JZG is bigger than, say, 9.65 J plus minus, indeed you get a quantum spin linkage state. So as a model, this is a fact. So you can actually have a quantum spin linkage. So there's non-perturbative proof. Okay. Now the real question is what happens if you add other terms, yeah? And okay, so another question is why this is described by U1 gauge theory. So here's one way to think about this. So this is my spin ice Hamiltonian. Here is transverse fluctuation. Now you can do some kind of degenerate perturbation theory in terms of J plus minus divided by JZ. Then the leading order term looks like this. It turns out that the leading order effective Hamiltonian is something like a ring exchange Hamiltonian along this ten-sided loop. So you can show that on the paracloth lattice, the six-sided loop is the smallest length loop. Okay. So now you starting from this, what one can show is as follows. So you can identify. So imagine that I like to rewrite my spin operator like this. So this one I call some kind of electric field. This one I call e to the I times some magnetic vector potential. And you know that basically what S plus minus does is to increase or decrease the SG quantum number. Yeah? That we know. Okay? Now, if you think about this E field as a number operator, this guy as a phase operator, and you know that these two variables are canonically conjugate. And with that construction, you can show that this is basically exactly what it does. If I rewrite it at e to the I some phase, the number operator, if they are canonically conjugate, then this operator can increase or decrease this quantum number. Okay? Okay? It's just like that. So this is a faithful representation of spin operator. In fact, we know that in electrodynamics, electric field and magnetic vector potential are canonically conjugate variable, if you remember your electrodynamics lesson. So using this representation, you can immediately write down an effective Hamiltonian where your ring term that I talked about, this ring term, becomes cosine of curl of A. Curl of A is some kind of magnetic field. And then you have a constraint that this guy, Sig, has to be either plus half or minus half. So you put a constraint like that. So then notice that this is basically lattice version of a quantum electrodynamics because this is E squared. This is if you expand in the continuum, then you get a curl of A squared, that's B squared. So notice in the continuum, my Hamiltonian is just exactly B squared plus E squared. That's the action for electrodynamics, right? Yeah? So that's the reason why the original model, XXG model, can be mapped to compact U1 gauge theory. So U1 gauge theory, or usual electrodynamics, on the lattice. And because of the lattice structure, you get a cosine. And that's basically it. Okay? But it turns out that if you want to include other terms, you actually have to work harder. So in fact, various people worked out the phase diagram beyond that XXG model point. And there will be talks about this and posters and all that in the conference next week. And very, very recently, there are some exciting developments. So for example, this material, I think the data was obtained back in 2009. But so it looks like for this kind of material, this ytterbium, it's actually it's a Cramer's doublet. And that perhaps this can be described by this kind of model. So the point is that below 0.5 Tesla, they don't see any spin waves. But above 0.5 Tesla, there's some kind of magnetic ordering. So the question is whether the low field state can be a U1 spin liquid like what we described just before. So there will be talks about this. And also, I'd like to point out that other than this system, it's also a pristinium-based a particle material, in particular pristinium-2, zirconium-207, that also shows interesting neutron scattering behavior. And so that will be also discussed on Tuesday. So finally, I'd like to point out and notice that my SIG operator in this construction is basically electric field operator. So notice that in this case, right, basically, SG correlator is nothing but the electric field correlator. What that means is that this spin-spin correlator is directly related to the spectrum of my U1 gauge field. So when you're measuring structure factor of Eigen component, you are really measuring photon in this case. Okay? That's different from the previous case that I talked about. In the previous case, those photons don't carry any quantum number. You only carry entropy. But this one is different. This one actually carries SG quantum number. So in that sense, it's a direct way to see a photon excitation, this quantum spin liquid. Okay, with that, I'd like to end the talk. Thank you very much. Yes. most likely G2 spin, okay?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Right. Okay. So this is DMRG calculation? Okay. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, but that's the model calculation. So as I told you for Herbert-Smith, so okay, that's the separate question. Okay, so if I have a Heisenberg model, the Kagome-Lattice, the ground state may be G2 spin, okay. Now, what we are interested in is the ground state of Herbert-Smith. Say, if I'm asking this question, then it's not obvious, right? But then, you know, we don't even know what the real Hamiltonian looks like. Yeah. So if it's not very far away from, say, Heisenberg model, and G2 spin naked has a spin gap, so presumably it's stable, right, up to some perturbation. So if that's the case, perhaps the ground state can, you know, still can be a G2 spin naked, right? That's right. So I think that's why sometimes it's useful to think about other competing ground state as well as the ground state of a model that we are considering. Because as you know, this is a first-hand magnet. So small perturbation sometimes can tip the balance. And as you know very well, the energy difference between competing ground states is very, very tiny. It's very, very small. So even if you change the Hamiltonian a little bit, sometimes you may get a different state. So I would claim that, you know, theoretically, we really have to think about a manifold of states that are very close in energy in such a way that depending on, you know, the modification of Hamiltonian, the real ground state may not be the same. It's just a comment. Okay, so if the gap is big, then presumably it is stable. Right. So the question was whether Kepler's spin naked is like some phase at the critical point, right? That's basically the question. Quantum critical point. Yeah. So the answer is yes. So you can think of this Kepler's spin naked as a critical phase, not a critical point. The point is that, you know, the spin correlator decaying algebraically. It's only valid at the critical point at t equals 0, right? But here, for a range of parameters, you know, spin correlator decays algebraically. So in that sense, this is a critical phase. It's a it's a continuous line of critical point. That's right. So for example, depending on what kind of spin you have, this power law, the spin correlation function, they actually do have anomalous dimension, just like a quantum critical point. In fact, that's one way to sort of experimentally determine whether your ground state is a critical point or a critical phase. So imagine that I'm changing my pressure, and I can tune, say, you know, between spin liquid and the magnetically ordered state. Yeah? So if this spin correlator is only algebraic, only near the critical point, then if you are slightly away from it, you know, basically there will be a cutoff, right, below a certain temperature. But if this is the critical phase, then you will still see a critical correlation down to very low temperature, even though you are further away, you're further and further away from the critical point. Yes. Okay. So, yeah. So the question is whether physons and spinons, whether the gaps are always well defined. Right. So the point is that this result that I mentioned was assuming that the physon gap is smaller than the spinon gap. But when you have more than one kind of gapped excitations, in principle, the ranking of the gap can be changed, right? For example, spin-on gap can be smaller than bijon gap. Bijon gap can be smaller than spin-on gap. So the result I showed you was basically true to make the effect most dramatic. Yeah? So when the Phi-Jung gap is smaller than the spin-on gap, then it's just that heat capacity sees both gaps, but susceptibility sees only one gap. So in fact, this is the way that we identified G2 spin liquid in some theoretical model. So the plot I showed you is a sketch of the numerical data. So we consider some spin model on the Kagome lice, again an XXG type spin model. And by measuring those heat capacity and susceptibility, we exactly found that. Other than, you know, there are other evidence, but basically that's the way it is. The point is, yeah, I mean, as far as there's a well-defined gap, that you do have a well-defined Phi-Jung or spin-on excitation.
Then let's thank Young Bak once again for a very